Welcome back to the program. Terrorism, tsunamis, earthquakes, war, drought, and the unpredictability of geopolitics. This past decade, even the past few years, have demonstrated that disasters of one form or another will continue to happen with increasing regularity, particularly in an increasingly speeded up world. How we plan for them, both personally and professionally, may very well determine the consequences of any given crisis. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Howard Kunreuther. He is the Cecilia Yen Ko Professor of Decision Sciences and Public Policy at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, and co-director of the Wharton Risk Management and Decision Process Center, and the co-author of a new book entitled Learning from Catastrophes, Strategies for Reaction and Response. Howard Kunreuther, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Jeff.
Are we seeing catastrophes happen at a more increased rate in the speeded-up world we live in today?
Well, I think the challenge on understanding that is to recognize that people are moving into hazard-prone areas. And as a result of that, when you do have a disaster, it is going to be a much more severe one than would have occurred in the past. Now, obviously, there are other factors in climate change we can talk about and maybe a partial explanation, but it's mostly the fact that people live in areas that are very nice until the disaster occurs, Florida being a very good example. More and more people are moving into the coast, and we've had more and more hurricanes there.
And, of course, the irony is that with more and more information available to us today, more and more knowledge about what areas might be safe or less safe, we continue to rush in where fools fear to tread.
Well, that's true. We like to think this is not going to happen to us.
Talk about our response to these disasters and whether the modern world has been any better in responding to them than disasters past.
Well, I think that it is certainly true. We've had better warning systems, certainly in the developed world. It's been a problem, as we know, with tsunamis in Asia and getting these warnings out or even having equipment to detect these events. And so there are fewer lives that have been lost as a result of that. I think the major problem has been the increase in damage to property, business interruption, not only the short-term but long-term impacts of these disasters. And that's what I think we have to start thinking about, how to revise our policies.
Have the economic impacts been greater?
Yes. The economic impacts have definitely been greater. We have a companion book, At War with the Weather, that came out last summer, MIT Press, that basically actually looked at precisely the question you're raising, that there were enormous, much greater increases in both insured losses and property damage from disasters than there have been in the past in both the developed world and in developing countries.
And in the developed world, are we seeing better government response? Are we seeing a more effective melding of both public and private sector response?
No question that there is more a greater response and concern about these issues. However, I think there are also misperceptions. When you go back to the late 60s, 70s and look at the disaster relief that was given to individuals, it was, I think, more extreme than it is today in the context of low interest loans and grants. People may perceive that they're going to get disaster relief, and of course the media has been playing up these disasters. But the fact is that from the point of view of the private sector, you will often have to fend more on your own than people may actually perceive. Now, when it comes to the public sector, there is a fair amount of relief that is given. I'll talk about the U.S. now in the way of reconstruction and recovery. But again, you have the problems of business interruption and longer-term losses, which I think we all have to deal with on a different level than even in the past.
What catastrophes here in the U.S. have been seminal in terms of really looking at them to understand where we are today in our response?
Well, I think the major issues have been really, well, with floods, hurricanes, and earthquakes. And in the context of very recent disasters, it is certainly the hurricanes that we had. We had a series of hurricanes in 2004, as you may recall, and four of them in Florida. Then, of course, we had Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And these were really watershed events. No one had ever experienced, and no one had even predicted, the notion of four hurricanes in one year in one state. and Hurricane Katrina we are talking about still today, and we'll be talking about for many years. In the 1990s, you know very well, being in California, that earthquakes were a major problem there and got a lot of attention. We just haven't had any major earthquakes in the state in the last 10 years, and so they have had less attention. And floods are a major problem and will continue to be a major problem. It's the ones that we have the largest amount of losses, trillions of dollars of potential losses, and they occur on a regular basis, and it's not quite the same level as the earthquakes and hurricanes.
Is there a danger, both in the developed and developing world, that we have so many of these catastrophes that at a certain point they all seem the same, we kind of turn off in our response?
Well, I think that's a very interesting point. I mean, there is a certain degree of numbing, and a colleague who I've worked with over the years, Paul Slovak, a psychologist, talks a lot about that. When you get these events and you get large numbers of people who are actually injured or damaged and whatnot, it's hard for us to know how to deal with that. And if it's not in our own country, then we often may actually neglect them. Although, as you well know, Haiti is a good example of a country which is poor and which had very severe losses, where we have paid a great deal of attention. Though the question is, how long will this last? Will the Chilean earthquake replace Haiti and another disaster would come on the agenda? So there are both elements of how do we deal with this, the large numbers that we don't quite know how to interpret, and then the fact that another disaster or another crisis takes over, and then we forget.
And the other part of it is, and this relates to the numbing you talked about before, the question not so much will Chile replace Haiti in terms of our focus, but will Chile be ignored because our attention is still focused on Haiti, and do we have a kind of compassion burnout?
No, I think you're right. I think that's a good, that's a point we'll see how that materializes in the next few weeks. I think there are a couple of reasons, and you've hit on one of them, and the fact is Haiti is poor. Haiti had no building codes. Chile is not rich, but they've had well enforced building codes. They had much fewer casualties, and so there's less reason that people may want to pay attention to Chile, and they may already, as you say, have already said, well, look, we contributed to Haiti. Do we really have to give to Chile as well?
Talk a little bit about how the Chinese have dealt with disasters. One thinks about the Sichuan earthquake and other things. Talk about how they're approaching these disasters and catastrophes.
Well, I think the major difference, and I'm not an expert in China, so let me say that at the outset, but I've read a bit about it, and in our book we certainly have a discussion and I should indicate that in this book, Learning from Catastrophes, it's edited by my colleague and myself, Mike Useem and myself, but there are really 20 authors who have their perspectives, and one of them has discussed China in some detail, and so I really take my cue on this from Lan Xu, who has written about a chapter on exactly the Chinese situation. I think the challenge really in that China has faced is that they've had major damage from earthquakes, and they have prepared. They really have a system which actually takes steps beforehand, lets the people know what to do, and really follows through in a very systematic manner. And as a result of that kind of preparation, the Chinese have done very, very well, certainly after their recent earthquake, as you know. And so that's one of the challenges, and we faced that challenge in Katrina. We really weren't quite ready for Katrina, and our responses were slower than perhaps should have been the case.
It seems to me that there are three very specific legs to this stool. They don't always work in harmony, looking at all of the things some of these people are writing about. There's the assessment of the risk, the management of the risk, and then the response.
And I would add also the perception of the risk. I would like to add that, Jeff, because we have the assessment of the risk that really is what the experts say, but then as a public we may perceive the risk differently, as we've been discussing on in some of your earlier questions. So I think it is that perception and that assessment, and then the management coming out of those two, which impacts on the recovery.
What can the public sector learn in the assessment of and management of these risks from the private sector and the way that sector has been dealing with these kind of issues for years?
Well, I think that's the challenge that we face today. Just the point you're raising, what can we all learn? And one of the areas that we have been working on in our risk center, well, a number of other groups around the country and the world, is how can we get better information to the public? How can the public be aware of when they are safe and not safe? And what we have been focusing on primarily is the tremendous importance that insurance can play in dealing with this, in both providing information to individuals, the public, in terms of the nature of the risk, but also to encourage them to take mitigation or adaptation measures to make their homes safer so that they will not suffer as much damage. And right now, the system needs a really significant revision over what it currently has to do that. I think what really we need is we need a new system of at least insurance in the context of these catastrophes and property insurance, which really has the premiums that reflect the risks, so that if you are moving into an area, you will know exactly how risky that area is. And the premium is a signal for your safety. Now, when you have a premium reflecting risk, you also can encourage people to invest in mitigation measures and measures to reduce the losses, because that will decrease the premiums. And as a result of that, they will say, I'm getting something back for having done, for doing something, for taking some protective measures. That doesn't exist today in many areas, and certainly Florida, which we discuss, mention in this book, Learning from Catastrophes, but also in At War with the Weather, really highlights essentially the fact that today you have, in high hazard areas, premiums that do not reflect the risk. You have a state or a group of citizens that is actually marketing a lot of insurance, and you also have regulators that are controlling the rates. Now, there's a very good reason for the regulators to be in that business. They can prevent insolvencies, et cetera. But what we are suggesting here is that, in a sense, the regulators do not limit the premiums. We recognize, however, that if you have premiums reflecting risk, there are going to be a number of low-income and poor individuals or people who need special treatment who are going to say, I can't afford that. And so the second principle that we are suggesting, the first one being premiums reflect the risk, is that you need to deal with equity and affordability issues, but you need to deal with them not through insurance premiums, but by grants or some kind of vouchers to those individuals who are living in these areas, and then if the premiums reflected risk would say, I just can't afford it, and rightly so, understandably so. And that would be very much like a food stamp is given for people to buy, low-income people to buy food. Why not an insurance stamp in a similar fashion? So if we have those two things combined, all of a sudden insurance now takes on the role that you're raising, that the public then says, well, wow, if I move into this area, I'm going to have to pay a large amount for my premiums, and maybe it isn't as safe as I thought it was, and I may need to reconsider this. So that's the first part of our program, and the second part, or at least a proposal, and the second part is, let's make insurance a long-term proposition. Let's think about insurance in the context of a multi-year insurance policy rather than a one-year policy, and let's make multi-year loans to encourage adaptation, to deal with the fact that we tend to be, all of us, myself included for sure, tend to be somewhat short-sighted. We look at what we're going to get back next year, and so you have to somehow move away from the notion that everything is, that when you pay for a mitigation measure, you have to pay all the costs up front. Give people a long-term loan, and give them a premium reduction, and maybe the cost of that measure will be overcome by the reduction in the premium. So that's a basic set of ideas that would let people know how hazardous the area is, tie the insurance to property, and give them loans to help them to do a better job of reducing the risk. And then those who want to move into the area will have to pay what a premium that really reflects that risk.
Particularly with respect to premiums, why hasn't the marketplace made this adjustment? Why haven't insurance companies been allowed to do that? And where they haven't been allowed, why are they still in the market?
That's a very good question. And, I mean, they haven't been allowed to do it because regulators are concerned with, and understandably with equity issues and say, I'm not sure that this is going to help us a great deal if we, if people are going to have to pay these high premiums, which is why we advocate this notion of insurance stamps. Why have they stayed in the market? Because a company, a company that, for example, in the state of Florida, that it would be unhappy if they were, in that area because of, just what we're talking about, may lose a great deal of other business, that may be reasonably profitable to them. So it's a complicated question in terms of just that point. But in general, I think insurers have to balance all of this off, and our feeling is that you don't want to sort of make this a highly profitable, an industry that is making unnecessary profits, make it a more competitive industry by letting the having the regulators somehow say, we are willing to let you price these products, and we want competition to keep the prices at a reasonable level.
The other part of it that one of the authors talks about in the book is not only the potential danger, but the probability that there are high probability and low probability events.
Well, right. The insurance premium is determined by not only a catastrophic event like a severe earthquake in California, if you would have earthquake insurance, but it could be a minor earthquake or an earthquake that does a limited amount of damage. And that would be true with a homeowner's policy. You could have fires, for example, that are covered in a homeowner's policy that would not really destroy a house, but could cause sufficient damage that you're happy to have insurance to help pay for that. Those losses.
We've been talking about it with respect to natural events, be they earthquakes or floods or hurricanes. What about man-made events, acts of terrorism, and how we begin to assess the risk for those kind of events?
Right. Good, interesting question. I think that the terrorism raises its own set of dynamics on a couple of different levels. One is we don't have the kind of data as we have on natural hazards for dealing with terrorism. Seismologists and dealing with earthquakes and other ex-meteorologists have collected a fair amount of data to be able to say something about what the likelihood of these events are, and then the engineers can talk about the damage that would actually occur should a house be should an earthquake occur in a hazard in an area like in California or a hurricane occur. So we have that information in the context of natural hazards. When it comes to terrorism, we don't have any really good handle on exactly what the probability will be of another terrorist attack and where it will occur. But there's another element which makes this a little different from natural disasters. With a natural disaster, acts of God, there isn't anything that you're going to do that will change the fact that the hurricane or earthquake will occur. What you can do, of course, is reduce the damage in the way that we were just talking about by making your house property safer. With a terrorist, if a terrorist knows that you're doing something, it's a game that can be played, and they may say, look, if they're going to take protective action here, we're going to go somewhere else. And so you have those two elements that make it a lot harder to deal with terrorism, and you also have, as a result of that, the federal government has gotten in with terrorism in a way that it hasn't in the same way with natural disasters.
Is there an element of risk assessment that separates both property damage from loss of life? And are there situations where there's an inherent conflict between the two?
Well, I think that the earthquake area is an interesting area with respect to that, because in many ways the whole area of performance engineering and designing better structures is now becoming a much more important element in the earthquake side, that you're talking not only about loss of lives but of structures where that was not necessarily the case 20 years ago. But to some extent, there's a complementarity. I mean, if you have a safer property or more well-designed property, the hope is you would be losing fewer lives as a result of that. So from the vantage point of bringing the two together, they may be complements. I think the insurance companies, of course, look at them as part of maybe a broader set of policies. If people have a life insurance policy, if people have a health insurance policy that their company is offered, which is maybe different as we move forward in the future, then they would say any disaster will have multiple impacts on us. And we would like to do the as much as we possibly can to reduce these losses. I think the best example of where action has been taken is where the in the automobile area, where the Institute for Highway Safety, which has been partially supported by the insurance industry, has really designed better car, helped to design better cars, and try to reduce the potential losses. And that goes not only from the point of view of damage to the car, but the possibility of injuries and loss of life.
What can both the public and or private sector do in terms of providing further leadership in these areas?
Well, I think we have to begin to recognize that, and this is what our book talks about in Learning from Catastrophes, on a number of catastrophes, as you've indicated, not just natural disasters. We have to recognize we're in a new era of catastrophes, and you started your program really often with that note, that things are getting more severe, and if we recognize that, then we have to realize that we need to have better policies and better programs, and understand, first of all, what the nature of the risk is. And I think we need more transparency, more understanding in terms of what it is, the dangers we face, and then a better set of policy tools that will not only inform the public as to what's happening, but also help reduce the potential damages and from future disasters. That's what we have to do, and that's something that a group of us now are working at simply because of the fact we realize this is such an important problem.
Of course, the other overlay to all of this is the cultural construct in different parts of this country and certainly different places around the world that approach catastrophe in entirely different ways.
Right. And I think that's, I think one of the challenges, and this is an area that we are sort of thinking about in the context of Haiti, for example, where the UN and the World Bank are very, and other organizations are very concerned with respect to how are you going to develop a long-term plan for Haiti, given the fact that it has a very different culture, the fact it had no building codes, the fact that you have to figure out how money is going to be given and provided to the country so that you can have a long-term recovery strategy that will help reduce the losses not only from future earthquakes but future floods and hurricanes and other disasters. That's a major difference in the context of how you deal with that than dealing perhaps with countries in the developed world.
And of course that all has to be taken into consideration in this risk assessment and risk management that we talked about earlier.
That is correct.
Howard Kunreuther, the book is Learning from Catastrophes, Strategies for Reaction and Response. It's just out from Wharton School Publishing. Howard, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed our discussion, Jeff.
Thank you.